Rick, it's awesome to see you, and thank you for coming on the Bainbridge podcast.
Great to be here, Ben. I'm excited to be on as well.
Well, I'm going to embarrass you, but I really do think you're a god, or at least a demigod of e-commerce, given your background. It's incredibly impressive.
Can I put demigod of e-commerce on my LinkedIn profile?
Yeah, you should. You're up there on like Mount Olympus, you know.
Oh man, I don't know about that.
So, just for people's edification, Rick currently runs a consulting business focused on helping e-commerce brands. But prior to that, he got his start as a software engineer, a company called Auction Rover, eventually became channel advisor, rose through the ranks of channel advisor into senior product and engineering roles. And, you know, when you read through that bio, it's like you built so many of the tools that are, you know, that became enabled much of what we know of e-commerce. You did a stint at Barnes & Nobles. You then started a company called Merchantry, which was bought by Tradeshift, focus on helping brands, e-com brands manage marketplaces, right? Then you went to Pitney Bowes, focused on global shipping. And now you're doing your own thing. So I know I glossed over that, but it'd be awesome if you kind of gave your experience a little bit more depth so people got a real sense of you know, why I'm putting you on this pantheon of demigod.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. One thing, just as a point of quick clarification, I did not start Merchantry. I was promoted to CEO of Merchantry post Series A. So I joined as a head of operations. And there was already a board and a CEO in place, and the founders were on the board. And I'm still very well connected to Eugene and Eric today. But they asked me to run the business after being there about 6 or 8 months, which I did for then 3 years, and helped sell the business with the help of the board as well. So, but barring that, getting into e-commerce was in some ways accidental. Kind of my first love is software, and just software of all kinds. My master's, I got it, you know. So I have these sort of like two strange sides to me. One is like very technical, software oriented, and the other one is like I have the side of me that loves being out. I love public speaking. So and the way that manifested itself was I was in college. I was the only engineer on a debate team, and that kind of summarizes some of what I love to do. Just generally, because if I can find a job where I'm doing both sides of those things, then I'm a happier person. And I find that with my consulting firm, I can do most of those because my thought leadership is my marketing. And that nicely dovetails with me staying, being able to be self-employed for longer and longer. But I also get to solve deep problems. And I think anyone who's been at a company for a long time, I was at ChannelAdvisor for 10 years and different companies for longer than a year or two. You know that as a leader, you don't make big decisions every year.
Right.
You really make only a couple of big decisions a year. And the rest of the year, you're kind of just making sure that the wheels don't come off the car or something you decided that was important 2 years ago, but the seeds were planted long ago. It's not like I'm going to wake up tomorrow and the company's going to die if I make this wrong decision, because if that's the case, then the company's already in big trouble. Like there better be some momentum happening. And so one of the things I actually enjoy, this is not the question you asked, but I'll get there eventually, I think. One of the reasons I enjoy the consulting business is because I get to help CEOs and boards make big decisions every day. So there's no reason you reach out to a consultant unless it's to help you make a big decision that has high stakes. To make a run-of-the-mill decision to, should I do this feature or that feature? Should I expand this product line to get 5% more revenue? That's not an interesting decision that you would spend money on a consultant for. And so I really enjoy those big decisions, not only because they're higher stakes, but also because they're complex. One of the reasons I really just loved software to begin with is it's a complex space that's changing. And as I grew up in the space, Microsoft was the leader. And so he was kind of an early person that I followed kind of throughout the 80s, even, you know, growing up. And I had an Apple II, was my first computer. But kind of going out of grad school, I kind of had the choice of e-commerce, like, where should I go? And really, my choice was small company or big company. So I actually could have joined Microsoft as a QA engineer.
Wow.
And so their QA engineers at Microsoft are like not a typical QA. Their engineers are writing code to test big platforms.
Right.
Or I could join a small software company in North Carolina that was writing developer tools for Microsoft applications.
Right.
Neither of those companies were in e-commerce. It just so happened that the smaller company was founded by Scott Wingo, who then later on went to start Channel Advisor.
Right.
So I happened to be with a group of people whose next idea was in e-commerce because e-commerce was starting to take off in 99. And I'll be honest, like I have nothing but the utmost respect of what the Channel Advisor guys have created, not the least of which reason is they were first to that market. They still today run one of the only profitable SaaS businesses out there. Like, it's very hard to find profitable SaaS businesses, period. Yeah. And Channel Advisor is one of them.
Yeah.
And not only like the original ideas that Channel Advisor was based on, like Scott had three ideas and each of them became multi-hundred-million-dollar businesses.
He just picked
one of them was like the idea of a comparison shopping engine.
Okay.
You know, back in 99, which is obviously a huge industry. Like you may have heard of this entire industry.
Yeah.
But the idea at the time was that eBay was big, but it wasn't the only auction site.
Right.
There were like 80, no one remembers this anymore, but there were like 100 auction search engines out there, you know, for baby things. And the idea is like, we wanted to make it easy for buyers to, was basically, we were like a meta crawler for auction search.
Okay.
And so along that journey, we started developing seller tools. So that's kind of where I started. I was like writing, when I started, I wasn't really on the buyer side. I actually, the first code I wrote for Auction Rover was for sellers. And so our target was eBay power sellers. And at the time it was mostly people who had trading cards and like whatever it is with once. We got Auction Rover got acquired by GoTo.com, who invented the paid search engine, incidentally, and then got crushed by Google.
Nobody
in like
that
March 2020. Which is like a month before, like just another reason that Scott and the management team were brilliant is they have to be any kind of founder is you realize you have to have a little bit of luck and timing, and to sell your business a month before the .com bubble burst is pretty great luck and timing.
Right.
But the short story is we were part of GoTo.com for a year, which was like, so we got to ride out kind of the worst of the bubble first as part of a public company. So that actually was sort of like, you know, a whole nother funding round. And we kept working on our sellers tools. And we found out during that period that Sun Microsystems, which doesn't even exist anymore, signed up for our free auction sales tool and sold $50,000 in used servers on eBay. And that was really the light bulb moment behind Channel Advisor is like in 2000,
yeah.
It's like people, big businesses are going to use marketplaces to earn a living.
That's cool.
And so that kind of just really started the love of e-commerce. I didn't grow up with a father who's in retail. He's in finance. I didn't, you know, my mother, like nothing like that. I don't have a retail history at all. My history is technology. And a love of trying to figure out hard problems. And e-commerce matched all of those things that I loved doing because obviously at the very beginning of its inception.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't even commercially transact on the internet before they passed a law in like 92 or something. So that's kind of the genesis of my time in e-commerce, and it's been time at software companies, but as well as at brands like Barnes & Noble, helping them build out marketplaces. But a lot of my ideas and thoughts that I write about on LinkedIn and my podcast, and even bring to my clients and engagements are just based around having been around the block a few times,
right,
having seen a few things. When I tell people that I've worked with Amazon before they had a marketplace, most of them don't even understand like how to compute that.
Yeah.
It was like, what do you mean Amazon didn't have a marketplace? Like, well, actually what the marketplace they have today is like their third version of the marketplace. And the first two really didn't work very well at all.
Wow. I didn't know that.
They actually the first Amazon's first attempt, if we're going to divert here, and I'm like totally derailing your agenda, is Amazon straight copied eBay. They built an auction site, and
yeah,
you can go to Amazon auctions and find things. It completely failed because the world didn't need another auction site, and so they actually their second attempt was something called Z Shops, which was essentially a new tab to allow like very small brands to set up their own like little mini storefronts on Amazon. But it was not integrated with the rest of the site. You had to go to the Z Shops tab and find this merchandise. What Amazon learned from this idea, so this also failed miserably.
Yeah.
But it got a little bit better. Because they recognize the importance of providing tools for sellers. But where it didn't work is that none of these pages got any traffic. And so Amazon selling these huge, you know, books and things, the main search engine, Z Shops were always at the bottom. And so I think the key insight behind the Amazon marketplace was really the innovation of the product page. Like just the idea of having a single product detail page for an item that anyone can win, Amazon or anyone else, that was almost a historical accident. And I would say we might even not have marketplaces as we define them today if Jeff Bezos himself didn't have to override his whole company to make that idea happen. So if you read, Brad Stone has probably like one of the most interesting, you know, histories of Amazon, and we even know back in the day, like most people at Amazon did not want third party sellers to be able to own the product page. It's counterintuitive. Like, why do you want competition on your site? And so I think that idea really allowed third party sellers to gain traffic equal to any other player on the platform. And that was really the innovation that powers the rest of everything. All their investments in fulfillment all came, like the genesis of it is kind of back to that kernel of an idea. So anyway, happy to be on the podcast.
Well, you set this up perfectly. So, you know, where are we going now? I mean, I know you have strong opinions about this, and just to give a little bit of context, you know, it's clear that e-com has become a system of platforms. You know, back in the day, you had to build everything yourself, including payment infrastructure. And now there's, you know, platforms for virtually everything. You know, you've been in that, you've worked with the big platforms, you know, eBay and marketplaces and Amazon. Like, where are we heading?
Yeah, I think as we're heading forward, I think you're going to see a little bit more fragmentation. And the reason is because the categories that Amazon doesn't already own are more fragmented. And they're not necessarily the same consumer like you and I that are going on Amazon and receiving, I don't know how many Amazon boxes a week I receive, but it's a lot.
Too many.
Yeah. And everyone I talk to has the same response. Like, I get too many Amazon boxes. So if you're buying chemicals to power your warehouse manufacturing process to produce a product, you can't go on Amazon to buy it, and you never will, because those chemicals are regulated. You need to know who you're buying from. You need to know what they use it for. It needs to be transported properly. There are a lot of industries that aren't just selling a shoe and shipping it to someone who could then ship it back to you.
Yeah.
And I think broadly, if I think about the biggest opportunities to unlock e-commerce value, they're in these undigitized industries and categories that you and I as a consumer would never think about. But if you and I worked for Boeing aircraft,
we would see all
around us. You know what I mean? If you and I work for Ford, we would see all around us.
Right.
Or just pick an industry and kind of go there. There are lots of opportunities for B2B commerce that I think are exciting for the future that yes, they're digitally enabled, but they're also very different from how the past has looked.
Is B2B commerce a good name for this?
It's the best name I've seen. Another way, the procurement industry, I would say writ large, comes at this from a different angle. So the people who are in commerce call this B2B commerce. If you're from like the procure to pay space, and you deal with like electronic invoicing and how big companies pay smaller companies, kind of that invoicing and cash creation process, procurement has broadly two big categories. One is direct procurement, basically direct spend, and the other is indirect spend.
Yeah.
Indirect spend is basically everything you need to buy to run a business, but it's not essential for the goods and services that is your core operation. Meaning, if I am a engine manufacturer, and I need to have an office, and that office needs to have chairs and desks.
Right.
Those chairs and desks is what they call indirect spend in the procurement industry.
Yeah.
Now, and indirect spend, I think Amazon could eat most of those categories with either its main site or with something like Amazon Business, which is incidentally has been eating the long tail procurement for many years.
Yeah.
The top end of that market, kind of the head of the indirect procurement, of like very strategic supplier relationships. Like if I'm going to have 25 offices around the world, it probably doesn't make sense for me to go to Amazon every time I need a desk. It probably makes sense for me to find the best vendor and to negotiate, you know, like we normally do for big things. But on the direct procurement side, I think is where is the more interesting part of B2B. So like if you have an engine block that has, let's say 40 parts, and each of those parts are produced in different countries. And not only to that, you also have bearings, and you need different fluids and oil and transmission fluid and like whatever. It's like, where do you procure those things? That kind of commerce, I think, is you and I would never see it, but I think it's also like really fascinating to track, and it's also massive.
Yeah. Yeah. Can we jump? I think you're absolutely right, right? B2B is this massive, unexplored, to be tapped universe. A lot of our people, though, are on, consumer, right? D2C. So I'm going to hold your feet to the fire a little. Like, what's the future of D2C vis-a-vis the platforms?
Yeah, I think D2C, as far as the platforms, I don't think you're going to see anything major, or like, I don't see anything that like fundamentally threatens the success of what Amazon does really well and is good at. And conversely, I also don't think, the individual direct-to-consumer experience or the bricks and mortar retail experience by a good retail operator, which is an important caveat for the last thing. There are a lot of bad retail operators that I want to say deserve to go out of business, but you're not surprised when they do, put it that way.
Yeah.
I think those trends are being one of the most important factors that Amazon bet on 20 years ago that some of their competitors did not, was the importance of convenience. And really the primacy of convenience over many other factors. And obviously selection is important too, and good enough price is important too, but convenience is, you know, half the ball game by itself. And the company that is the most convenient is the winner. And I think if you look at the highest growth areas of direct to consumer e-commerce right now, a lot of it is these offline businesses. It's actually these sort of like traditional retail businesses. You know, for instance, what is the highest growth area at Target? It's curbside.
Okay. Oh, wow.
It's like powering over half of their online growth. And so the idea between like what's direct to consumer, Target's a retailer. If a consumer is sitting on their phone in the store, and they're on their phone, and before they walk out, and they're on a couch, and they're talking to their friend, but they also want to walk out something, and they transact on their phone, but then they go to the back of the store to pick it up. Is that an online purchase or not? The answer is, who cares? Really, it's not about the channel; it's about the experience. And so I think I still think there is a lot of room to run in retail with better experiences for consumers that they value if we actually ask them and we measure them and we can actually see that they deliver value. It's not going to be like gimmicks, but I think just the fact that we're just now in 2020 realizing how much of a huge thing something like curbside is, now that anyone who's done it is like, holy cow, I couldn't believe I didn't do this 5 years ago.
Right.
And it, like, e-commerce isn't a new thing. Yes, I've been doing buy online, pick up in store, but I mean, the goal is to make that maximally difficult a lot of times.
Right.
Right? Like, you have to walk to a desk that sometime, maybe it's in Lowe's, it's in the front of the store. Sometimes in the back of the store, you can't find it. You have to find a person there. Walmart tried to make these towers of things that would, you would scan a barcode and like spit out a package, package to you. And so I think there's a lot of, I kind of look at curbside and all these delivery areas. This is all supply chain innovation. In many ways. And so I think one of the most exciting elements of technology growth that investors are seeing, and I think brands are having, is just shifting their supply chains from something that's like very rigid. I have this stock, I need to sell it to a retailer. The retailer puts it in the store. The consumer has to go to the store to learn even what's there. And so that's not a very convenient experience. It's much more convenient if I can shop online before I go to the store so I can make that trip more efficient.
Right.
Or even if I know if there are three things I want, I'd rather have them there when I'm walking the door.
Yeah.
And then I can keep shopping. And so that convenience element, I think the 5% of the industry has figured that out and is doing a good job of it. But I think the 95 still is not. And so I think convenience will still continue to drive innovation. And I don't pretend to be able to predict or understand what specifically that will mean for every retailer. But I do believe that convenience will drive a lot of it. I also think that cost pressures will drive a lot of it too. In the long term, in the short term, venture capital dollars can make up for a lot of mistakes.
Right.
Meaning like I could start a company tomorrow and saying like, you can buy this pen in 5 minutes and I could have it to your house in 10 minutes.
Right.
the reality is everyone doesn't need a pen in their house in 10 minutes. And so in a three-year period, that it will seem like a fantastic idea, but over a 5-year period, it will seem like a terrible idea. And so I think we're getting to the point where the market is starting to, I think just beginning now to sort itself out versus what we're seeing, what are the sort of the fads in the direct consumer market versus what's going to have real staying power, because there's not only real brand advantage to having a great experience, but almost equally as importantly, important, there's an economic advantage to delivering the experience in that way. And it's sustainable to do that because you can do it profitably.
Yeah, I think that's, you're hitting on such an important point there with convenience. And I love how you framed it, because, you know, there's this, people jump to like, oh, free shipping or fast shipping, which maybe for their category, the customer really doesn't care about. Like, yeah, if you offer it to me, like, why wouldn't I want it, you know, today and for free? But do I really need, you know, my ski pants in August? No. And I think that that has, and it's such a huge part of the P&L, you know, the shipping and the logistics. Like, so if you could figure out the way to do that more effectively, and what really is convenience. I think what you're saying is like, you almost, as a brand, want to have a vector of like, how important is convenience? What does convenience mean to my customers, and where am I going to live on this vector?
Right.
Of the competition.
And I think different types of brands, convenience means something different, because it depends on how they are going to use this product in their life. What problems they're trying to solve with your product. It also depends on how considered a purchase is it. And in some ways, making it the pre-purchase experience needs to be as convenient as the instant that you buy it, and then the use of it. Obviously, that's the part that Apple was always so great at, which is like, Steve Jobs was also famous for saying, like, form is function. And so you can't have a usable product that's not actually usable. It can't just look pretty.
Yeah.
And so you need both. And so I think we're seeing that convenience for a direct consumer brand. I always really love brands that focus a lot on the decision-making process a buyer needs to go through in order to decide that this product is the right one for me. Mm-hmm. It's really, to me, it's like super interesting when brands are focused on that, rather than just saying like, oh, it's available, they should know why to buy this one.
Right. Hey, you, just switching gears, well, a little bit, you had this really interesting blog post. I think it was back in May. You were listening to the Shopify earnings call. And you know, your blog post, I think it was like entitled, like, I can't believe they're about to let the Trojan horse in. And what did you mean by that? Like, and what are the sort of, tease out the consequences of that? Because I thought that was, you know, a really interesting point.
Yeah. So I think the question we have is, Amazon has this new program called Buy with Prime. And what they're trying to do is essentially an extension of what they started a little bit with Amazon Pay, which is try to expand their reach into more direct, away from their marketplace, and how can we get a piece of the pie from traditional direct to consumer sites? And the short answer is, we have this huge asset that everyone, at least in North America and a growing potential of people worldwide, knows is Prime. We have this great fulfillment service. Like, could we convince brands to use our fulfillment service and essentially give everyone else the Prime promise?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, sell, you know, at the same time, incidentally, selling all direct-to-consumer brands this, you know, our payment and fulfillment services, and generate that additional revenue stream. So I think Shopify is in a tough spot regarding the prevention side of it. I mean, in a manner of speaking, they almost can't really prevent it, in that the technology to do it, if Shopify were to be so closed off as to not for it not to be possible,
yeah,
then it probably wouldn't be a viable platform anyway. You couldn't add normal JavaScript on the page and plugins and be able to put a headless front end on it, for instance. So there's only so much control as a platform Shopify truly has. Yes, they can have a terms of service and they can enforce that. But that's also a very expensive and potentially even litigious proposition for mm-hmm. them. And so I think it was a little bit more philosophically that Shopify, the thing I was more alarmed by is not necessarily that they would allow it, because I think the fact that they allow it is almost something that they should welcome, because they shouldn't, like, if you're a Shopify management team, it's not like you don't want brands on Amazon. Amazon has a purpose.
Right.
They introduce your product to new customers.
Right.
You shouldn't avoid Amazon categorically. And I think that's true of most things in
right.
life. To just have a blanket policy against it is probably the wrong move. However, it is an indication that this is something that consumers should care about. And maybe Shopify, I need to pay attention to it too.
Yeah.
So I think the thing I was most alarmed about was when Toby said on the call that we love what Amazon is doing and we plan to support it like wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, if you like follow the end of that rainbow, I don't think that ends well for Shopify.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because Amazon is not viewing this as a partnership approach. That's really not how they think about
yeah.
the world. For Amazon, the world is a little bit more zero sum. Of course, yes, they want to grow the pie. Do they think they're going to be the only retailer on the planet? Probably no. But, you know, your margin is their opportunity.
Right.
That's kind of the motto. Amazon always wants scale, and they want to deliver consumer value. And if they can do that at your expense, they don't care at
right.
all. So I think I was a little bit alarmed that Shopify had not thought through its strategy for even messaging how they think about Amazon in the world, other than previously it was like Amazon is the evil empire. I mean, that was the messaging out of Harley in particular,
right.
and others. And to have Toby on a call sort of 6 months later spout the opposite message, just it told me something about where they were in their decision-making process, maybe still are.
Yeah.
And deciding, like, how do we think about this as a firm? I'm quite certain it had something to do with them spending $4 billion on a logistics software company in Deliver. I'm not certain if it had something to do with them trying to buy a robot company three years ago in Six River Systems. But there are a lot of logistics assets that I think are interesting for Shopify to invest in. I think the how is the rub there.
Yeah.
And as a software platform that, look, most SaaS platforms generate, you know, I think their payments business is roughly, what, 30% margin. Their platform business is probably something like 50% margin, if I remember these numbers properly. The logistics business is not those things.
Right? Yeah.
So... that I think that is the big worry for investors.
Yeah.
Like if I'm a Shopify investor, like why do I need to own this versus why do I need to provide these services through partners?
Right.
And so that's really, I think, what Shopify is going to wrestle with really over the next, almost regardless of which decision they choose. There's no, I would say, obviously right answer that has no downsides, because I think each lane they pick will have downsides, but you know, and upsides. So that's to me, that's why it's so fascinating to speculate
yeah.
and comment on.
That's really helpful. What other platforms do you think are interesting, or you know, that people should be paying attention to? I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about Amazon versus Shopify. What about like other marketplaces? You know, there's.
Yeah, I think other marketplaces, you know, I think a lot of it depends on where you are. Target and Walmart are obviously, I think, at the top of the list.
Yeah.
You know, for a lot of brands, I think after that it falls off really fast.
Okay.
Now, where it doesn't fall off really fast is if you're in a specific category. You know, if you're a lighting manufacturer, like you probably need to be on Home Depot and Lowe's. And is that a marketplace or not? Is it drop ship? But I mean, they're likely a retail customer, but they also likely require you to drop ship. And so I think some of these retail stores are, you know, have had pretty robust drop ship programs for some time now, and they're starting to push more supply to the drop ship side or virtual inventory side rather than taking more stock.
Right.
And so I think you see even some of these bigger retailers, you know, developing their own marketplaces. And I think in categories, there's a strange phrase that I agree with, but it sounds weird. But like the riches are in the niches. And so like if you're in a niche of your industry,
Right.
you can't just sort of say in a paragraph like what marketplaces people need to be on.
Right.
The reality is, do I agree with the software vendors that you need to be in 100 marketplaces? I would say almost certainly
Right.
no. But I think there's a list of three or four marketplaces that are probably very important for the average brand,
Yeah.
but they may not all be the same three or four.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I want to switch gears a little bit. We touched on it, and you've seen a ton of brands and companies, both successful and unsuccessful. How do these brands get to profitability? I mean, it's sort of this new, I feel like it's like a new concept for some of these brand leaders, right? Like, hey, we should get to profitability. But what are the commonalities that you see for profitable brands, and what are some of the common mistakes that you've seen people commit?
Wow. Usually the commonality for someone that is profitable. So I would say most brands that have been created in the last 5 years, I would say, as a rule, are unprofitable. As a rule.
Okay.
There are a few exceptions. And I think the exceptions are someone who identified an underserved niche that they could fill with a product that they understood why people needed it, and they didn't overspend for distribution. They relied on sort of the natural marketing of the product and didn't just try to grow as fast as possible and knock off someone else's product. And so I think the authentic founders that really understand their niche. I mean, I'll be honest with you, like probably 4 years ago, to me was like peak D2C, whereas D2C was what NFTs were 8 months ago.
Right. Like, gotta get
Like D2C got to get in, and every dinner party, like I had friends that would openly say like, which category should we enter next? And here's the formula. The price point is between $200 and $500, and it needs to be something that's easily manufactured overseas. And my product needs to be at a price point of about half of that. And so if I could come out with a $150 product, then I could grow really fast and attract investment. It was never the D2C hype train, if you just like put that in a lane, was never about profitability. It was more about growth. And I think they thought one day that if they could overtake the incumbent, they but you know, kind of famous to the old Warren Buffett saying is that, you know, in the short term, the stock market is what is it, like a perception. like whoever the hottest thing is going to win. But over the long term, the stock market is a weighing machine.
Right.
Like the fundamentals do matter over the long term.
Right.
And so I think the idea that a lot of these D2C brands were mostly they thought that these old brands don't understand anything. But I think after 3 or 4 years in business, most of them understood that what these brands had was distribution and profitable distribution. And that really matters because Warby Parker and Allbirds and Bonobos and all these folks mostly exited for the value of the investor, the investment that they got, which is you're not. The value to the world has not been incredibly accretive.
Right.
From an investment ROI point of view.
How fast does a brand get to profitability though? I mean, if it, you made it at the beginning, like, you know, of the past 5 years, like if I'm a founder, you know, recent founder, should my expectation be that I'm profitable on day one, you know, by the end of the first year? Like what would be sort of an accept? I know it changes by, you know.
To me, three to 4 years is kind of a reasonable expectation. And I think being profitable before then would be unusual because of upfront expenses, fixed expenses, like your staff and your technology and your marketing, because no one knows who you are. And so if you look at the P&L, and I know you'll like this, if you look at the P&L of an average company, I get this question always, like, how much marketing should I be spending? Like, well, at scale, most people will tell you that marketing should be about 7.5% of revenue.
Right.
At scale. That's for like a business. On the other hand, if you look at the average SaaS business, sales and marketing is like 40 to 50% of revenue, sometimes even more. But a startup can't spend 8% of their revenue on marketing because nobody would ever know who they are.
Right.
So there's a reason. Yeah. There's a reason that venture capital is important for a brand because you need to spend, you know, literally millions of dollars to start a new brand and to create awareness, but you need to do it in a way that you are attracting repeat customers.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that you can easily lose sight of in the rush to create a sexy brand is, are people coming back to me?
Yeah.
And why are they coming back to me? I would say is as important, if not more important, in the long term, than getting them the first time. And that gets into subscriptions and reuse and remarketing and all these things as well. So,
how do you define a brand? Because I would argue, like, one of my hypotheses is that the repeat purchase is a test of whether you have a brand or not. You know, can you get somebody to buy you again? Do you think?
It's a good question. Is it a test? I would say that's a test of loyalty for sure. Can you have a brand without loyalty? Probably. I think that's a case. It's just a matter of degree.
Mm-hmm.
Certain brands are more valuable than others because of the loyalty and trust and feelings and whatever they engender.
Right.
You know, there's a reason why Nike is one of the most revered brands in the world. There's a reason why Apple, even 3 years after Steve Jobs was fired as a CEO, was still one of the most revered brands in the world and had the opportunity to recover because it had some equity there. Even if people had stopped buying, there was still something to the brand. And so I would say I would disagree slightly that buying again means that there's no brand. But I think in the average consumer category, that means you have a valuable brand. I would 100% agree with that. I would say there was also like some considered purchases, which you don't buy very often.
Right.
You know, like a car,
right,
or like a sofa, or, and I don't want to put mattresses, or maybe not in this category,
but, right,
you know, anything big, expensive, like you don't buy too often, like the fence for my house, like there's a brand, or like the windows behind you, you know, like Pella,
right,
is a great brand, but it, you know, if I don't buy it in 10 years, it doesn't mean they're not a great brand. No.
Right.
I would say, I would go further in saying it's not just about you buying again. It's also about you recommending. If we're going to kind of follow this trail again,
right,
it's what, like, I had a friend of mine tell me this great quote. It's like, what is a brand? A brand is what you tell someone when they're not in the room. That's your brand.
Yeah, that's great.
And whatever that answer is, you're just like, yeah, I would use these people again, or no, I wouldn't use them again. Whatever it is, it could be a service, it could be a product. And so I think it definitely applies to D2C. You know, if you're on a mom's group on Facebook, you know, everyone's trying to get products that work for their kids.
Right.
And it's a hard process,
yeah,
you know, to anyone who's tried to raise a child.
Yeah. Any common mistakes that you see people making in getting to profitability?
Not tracking it is a big mistake. So I think the mistake that, so I tend to work with bigger companies that are trying to make a transition to direct consumer.
Yeah.
And the advantage that these companies have prior to going to direct to consumer is that the number of customers that matter is relatively small. You know, they might be selling to Walmart and Home Depot and Lowe's, and those are that's like 80% of their revenue,
right,
or something like that. And then the 20% is smaller specialty retailers and things like this. And they don't have that much to worry about. And so I think the famous saying that you don't make money when you sell, you make money when you buy, mm-hmm, is generally true, because when you're buying or manufacturing that product, you better already know what you're going to sell it,
right,
for. And I think if you're selling to the same person over and over, that can be, it's easier to determine that,
right,
because you're not setting the consumer price,
right,
you're setting the wholesale,
right,
price, based on your cost of goods.
Right.
Now, the other side of it is direct to consumer. It's just way more dynamic.
Yeah.
So the market is so much more dynamic that the muscles and the thinking and the technology and the organization that these brands don't have is, how do I know day to day, week to week, if this SKU is profitable?
Right.
And I think that is an entire... It's a skill. It, you know, it's not something that, you know, it's not like you were born with this. It's a skill that can be taught and can be learned.
Right.
If the organization is willing to learn it and prioritize,
right,
it. But that's not always the case in a brand where direct consumer is something that the sales team is maybe actively fighting against,
right.
which still happens to,
yeah, them. Well, let's talk about, let's finish with RMW Consulting, your consulting practice. You mentioned, you know, just a bit ago that your core customers tend to be brands that are moving into D2C, but who are the right people for you? Like, what do they look like? You know, who should be reaching out?
Yeah. So I would say there are two types of companies that mostly reach out to me, and a lot of it is based on kind of my background and the types of people in my network that I bring to engagements. One is private equity backed brands that are in the middle market,
yep,
that are trying to grow, I would say, digital commerce revenue broadly, not just direct to consumer, but also B2B, either through a marketplace or through their own direct channels. So they want more digitally enabled commerce with their customers. And it could be through a third-party channel or through a direct channel. And
okay,
so when I say the middle market of private equity, that tends to be companies in the range of $100 million in top line revenue, up to usually $1 billion in top line revenue. I have talked to larger brands, but those are generally covered by one of the larger consulting firms, Accenture, your Deloitte's, et cetera, that have the scale to match that. The smaller, the mid-market brands don't have the resources and won't get the best service from one of the larger firms because, and so that's a good match for a firm my size. And I would say the 300 million, like let's say a brand has 300 million in sales, don't be intimidated by that number because usually less than 10% of that number is direct to consumer before they meet me.
Right.
And so they might have I might talk to a $100 million brand that has a $1 million direct to consumer website. Wow. And that's, there are still many brands like that, even in 2022. And a lot of it is just prioritization and leadership and opportunities. And so when those sorts of companies reach out to me, usually it's a new owner. If it's a new owner that sees opportunity.
Got it.
And a new CEO comes in who has industry experience. They are product people.
Right.
They understand where the product gap in the market is for this brand that has some equity and reach, but they're kind of doing business in an old school way. And so they need, you know, digital thinking and technology and new ways of reaching their customers, better experiences to reach their buyers. So I help them sometimes acquiring businesses that can help them do that. I will assess acquisitions for them, but mostly about strategic planning.
Okay.
Like if you're going to be this, if you want to get your fair share, like, the way it comes to me is like, what's my fair share of direct consumer e-commerce for this brand?
Right.
And how do I get there? And so what I bring to them is the combination of a financial focus, which is like, how does your business work and how are we going to make money from a P&L perspective?
Yeah.
That combined with the customer experience. And so to me, that's one of the things that's unique about my firm is I try to bring both of them at the same time versus just like, let's just create a great experience and you're going to figure out if it's profitable. Not like usually the first thing I do is like, let's build a P&L.
So you
can see what is your path to profitability here and how do you, and one of the reasons I can say 3 to 4 years is because If you're a brand that's of any size that has some traffic that you're starting from, that's usually about what I see. Because you're investing in digital marketing, you're investing in a new tech platform, they're an agency to build it for you. And so I can add up the costs for them and kind of see that return on invested capital over time. So that's kind of one major segment. Another segment is software companies, actually venture-backed software companies or private equity-owned software companies, and they're generally, you know, well-funded software companies that are making a transition in their business. They want to amplify their growth.
Okay.
So they want to go to market in a new way. They want, you know, they feel like there aren't enough deals that they should be in, and so they need a new go-to-market strategy. Is probably the easiest way to do it. It's like, our company is lacking a North Star. We are positioning. It's kind of me too.
Yeah.
We have good technology, but we don't know how to tell a story to our buyers to get the market excited about what we're doing. And so I help them with messaging, competitive positioning, strategy, things in between what a normal, I would say, CMO or a head of product would do when they're positioning a new firm. So the way I think about it, like if a company comes to me, the way I think about it is like, if I were to relaunch this company, knowing everything I know today, what would I do and how I promote this company so that it's less about the bits and bytes like, oh yeah, we have this technology and it has AI, but no one cares about those things because otherwise we wouldn't be having a conversation. What the buyers care about is like how are you solving their problems and are you solving a problem that matches the top three priorities of the company really. And so if a CEO wouldn't tell their board about your product, either that's okay because you may not be a strategic buy and you could still be a very successful, like MailChimp is a great example. Hugely successful company, not a strategic purchase. But if you're a strategic technology purchase that are trying to routinely get over 100K for your software and services, for instance, then you better be on the top, the short list of the board's priorities, not just the CEO's priorities.
Yeah. And how do people get a hold of you?
Yeah, people get a hold of me. They can find me online. My website is rmwcommerce.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn. Just search for Rick Watson. Find me there. And I also, in the last year, I started my own podcast. I'm a guest on podcasts. So I have a podcast called The Watson Weekly, which I produce, every week. It comes out Monday morning, which is kind of a digest of e-commerce news and my commentary on it. So,
nice. Thank you, Rick. This has been really fun. I appreciate you being on.
Thanks a lot, Ben.